I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Yesterday, voters made some big decisions. One of them was who will be the next mayor of Kansas City, Missouri. Today, we'll talk with their choice, Quentin Lucas. He'll lay out his first plans of action as mayor-elect. We'll also ask political reporters about last night's city council election results and what they mean for the direction of Kansas City. Then, school may be out, but that doesn't mean the books have to be put away. Our friends at the Johnson County Library are back with recommendations for the best summer reads for kids, kindergarten through high school. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas City has a new mayor-elect. Quentin Lucas raced past Jolie Justice last night to become mayor-elect of Kansas City. He'll take over for Sly James later this summer with a new-look city council. This morning, we're going to kick around last night's results and what it all means. And we're joined now by the new mayor-elect, Quentin Lucas. And congratulations. What a night for you.
It's good to be here. Quite an honor. I never necessarily thought it would happen when I was a kid, and just proud of what the Kansas Cityans chose to do last night.
Well, when you were a kid, you never could have imagined this, right?
Absolutely not. I mean, when we were growing up, moving around all the time, you know, sometimes it was kind of, what will I even become in life? And to be able to get this opportunity today, it's amazing. And I think it's a story that I hope kids, wherever they are, take to heart. Perseverance and making sure you're not limited by your circumstances.
Did you have any sense, Quentin, going into last night that you would pull off this victory by 16 points?
No. I mean, just full stop, no. I thought it would always be much closer. Councilwoman Justice's campaign did some outstanding fundraising. I think they totaled about $1.4 million in the last month or so. A lot of that money was spent kind of giving descriptions of me that I didn't necessarily love on television ads. So I always thought it would be a little bit closer, but I am incredibly heartened by the result. I think it shows our field effort. We knocked on 60,000 doors, a record in a Kansas City mayoral race. I think the energy we had, and frankly, the issues, delivered us a real mandate last night.
I was going to say, why do you think voters ultimately went for you? What was it about your campaign and what you were standing for that drew so many votes?
You know, I think both in life story, but both in and also in my service on the council, people have seen that I'm somebody who supports this idea of walking and chewing gum. And by that, I mean that we can address big projects, we can address development, but we need to make sure, really first and foremost, we're looking at things like affordable housing, stability on the east side, improving our neighborhoods, making them safer, and making more opportunities for business, not just the large types that get incentives, but also those kind of smaller businesses in every part of Kansas City. And I think we saw loud and clear yesterday, that's what the voters want us to focus on.
You know, there's no doubt that you are biting off a big chunk of the apple here with your early agenda here. You just mentioned a safer city, affordable housing, better neighborhoods on the east side. I mean, those are no small challenges awaiting you as you step into City Hall.
You know, and I think there's a reason that I focus on it. People always ask me kind of, what's your big thing going to be? What's your big project? I think that focus is limiting. It's been limiting in Kansas City's history. It's limiting in lots of American cities. You can build all the big fancy things in the world, but, you know, a downtown stadium doesn't necessarily keep Baltimore from being a very dangerous city. You know, a lot of these other issues don't solve everything for us. So that's why I want to use my energy and frankly my capital on something like this, as opposed to something like this being public safety, housing, as opposed to just spending my time and saying, well, you know, we can look at one cool thing that we slap a name on later.
I mean, the scary thing here politically, at least on one level, is that solving or at least taking a chunk out of violent crime takes years. At least that's the experience in some cities. You're going to stake a lot of your capital on it, you just said, on that issue going forward. It might take you a while. What if that if you don't get immediate results.
You know, if I don't get immediate results, if I don't do something in time, I guess, you know, maybe I'm unsuccessful in a future race. But I think it makes a world of difference. You know, in running for mayor, I've studied past mayors. And New York City had David Dinkins as its first black mayor, who actually hired a number of officers, started a lot of the things that really led to that crime decrease under the Giuliani administration. Mayor Dinkins lost his first reelection and has been out of public life really since then. I think, however, it was important for his city, and I think you've seen the benefits there for a generation to come. I'd like to say that's the very same focus we need here. I mean, it's got to be more than just a big project. It's got to be more than talking about one thing. You want to be somebody who's saying, is the quality of life on 41st and Benton better after 4 years? Is the quality of life on Wacomas better? And that's what I really want to do. And then one last vignette in that. Before the election, I knocked doors in Ruskin Heights, a neighborhood that has so many challenges right now. And every person I talked to said, I'm voting for you, said, what are you going to do to make it safer here, fix things up, give my kids opportunities? That's what people really care about, and I think that's what they want in their mayor.
Mayor-elect Quentin Lucas is my guest. So what are the one or two things that Kansas City is not doing right now, Quentin, when it comes to violent crime that we need to be doing to turn this ship around?
You know, I think sometimes we're paying lip service to certain things, particularly in the mental health sphere, rather than truly funding it. I think we need to find consistent opportunities for funding for things like the KCPD social worker program, which is still just contract employees. We don't know how permanent they are with the police department. I'd like to see that become permanent. I think we continue to see not enough funding in our health levy that's going to mental health and indigent health care services in our city. And that does relate to crime long term, because you have a lot of folks that are dealing with trauma, a lot of folks that are dealing with issues every day who are not receiving the treatment they need and are instead being warehoused in the Jackson County Jail. Those are some of, I think, the key things that need to change. And then, you know, I'll say this final point. In terms of how we police, that's something we need to have more of a conversation on. I like the community interaction officers. I don't think they're enough. I've talked a lot on the campaign trail about neighborhood policing. I think we need to truly invest in that. Again, Kansas City's had elements of it, but it's always just been a pilot program. I'd like to see it really become an institution here long term.
You know, one of the burgeoning issues that came out of this campaign was this whole idea of affordable housing. And it seems to me like, in simplest terms, to begin to solve and take on that problem, you need money. And I'm wondering, where's the money going to come from?
You know, I think, and I've been challenged for this, but it is my view fairly clearly that rather than going to the voters for another tax increase, we have funding sources today that we are not leveraging appropriately. We have a central city 8-cent sales tax that comes from citywide that's supposed to be funding all types of things, but could include family housing development in the core of the city. Why not, with that fund that's generating $10 million a year, look to spend $4, $5, $6 million a year to help support the development of housing? That's something I think needs to be prioritized. We get $8 million a year from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Right now, we use it on a plethora of different projects, some of which including parking lots off of Prospect Avenue. My view always is, I'll let you have street parking up and down Prospect. I'd prefer housing. And so, you know, you look at that, and then you look at some misplaced priorities. It's not just parking garages in the Power and Light District. We just agreed to do a $3 million parking garage in the West Bottoms the other day. That's real money that can go to address some of these issues.
You know, Minneapolis has taken a real big step here in recent weeks by abolishing single-family zoning as a way to confront racism, as a way to confront affordable housing. There's a lot to think about there. Does a policy like that resonate with you?
You know, I'm very interested in it. I've served on the Board of Zoning Adjustment, actually, before I was on the city council. So I know enough zoning law to be dangerous. That being said, before we look to abolish single-family zoning, I think the first step is in these incentivized projects. We can look to, I think, be far more equitable in the development we're doing in places like downtown. And I do think, as we're building more subdivisions in different parts of the city, we do look to at least encourage things like more walkability. So I'm not necessarily saying abolish zoning, because I don't know if it works if you look at Houston, for example. But I do want to say, how do we actually just enhance it and come up with less restrictive zoning in a lot of our residential areas.
But the point is, there are some creative solutions being undertaken across the country. It sounds like you're interested in taking a look.
Well, you know, Steve, the thing is about affordable housing, it's only half a money issue. So much of it really is a policy one. It's how do we come up with better rules, right? Better policies that are allowing people to really develop in a way that I think is more conducive to working families, working folks in our community.
You know, in its editorial today, the Star said that you are sometimes prone to leaving people with the misimpression that he agrees with them. Is that a fair comment? And how will you approach that as you begin your term as mayor?
You know, I'll just say to that, whatever, which is a very elderly millennial way to respond. And I guess I'll just say it this way. Life is a journey where you have to learn all the time. You know, I think I'm clear, but you know, I'm a lawyer, and I'm good at on the one hand and on the other hand, and I recognize that perhaps there are some people that don't like that type of approach to speaking. So yeah. I will try to make sure I'm always clear. But I tell you, what I will not do is this. I will not just be one of those folks, as it happens too often in politics, where people say, I'm going to do this, be it heck or high water. And they don't listen to anyone. They don't actually improve what they're trying to do. They're not actually trying to come up with the best result. They're just doing it kind of because they're just doing it. And so I'm going to be someone who says, for example, on policing, I like neighborhood policing. That being said, in conversations with the police chief and others and criminology professors, is there a better way to do it? And I want to make sure we're not just getting things done, but we're getting them done well. That's my focus. And so that's what I'll work on.
You know, speaking of listening to other voices, you have said in the KCPT debate just the other day that you're open to offering a role or having a role of some sort for Jolie Justice, your opponent in the race for mayor. Can you envision today, I know it's only been a few hours, can you envision today what that role might be? Because she's expressed interest in staying engaged. She has a steep background in crime. She's done a lot of work in that area. What do you think?
You know, the area, so first of all, I want to commend her. I mean, I was asked this question earlier today, and they said, what do you think about the justice campaign and all of that? And I always say it this way. I think the world of Jolie Justice. I don't know if I love everybody from the campaign, but I think the world of her. And I think she's been an outstanding public servant. I hope she continues to, particularly on local issues. The area I would actually focus on is her work around transportation. I mean, I think when she talked about safe routes to school, when she talked about making a more walkable city. Frankly, you know, I know we get some seats in the KCATA board. I would love for her to be involved in working on issues relating to multimodal transit that she's been talking about and living for years. And the city is the better for her efforts there. It would be bettered by her participation there.
You know, I want to be real clear in the minutes we just have left with you, Quentin, that this notion, this theme that you've laid out about you want to go bold here. That's an important word to you here. When your term is over, what's that idea going to look like? Give residents the best roadmap you can right now of what a bold Quentin Lucas for your term is going to appear to be.
I want people to kind of be able to see a few things. One, that we have a safer city. I want to see us get below 100 homicides for like 2 years in a row, not just one. I want to see us out of the top 10 most dangerous cities list. And then in terms of kind of two other areas, infrastructure and housing. In housing, I want to see us have, rather than pilots and short programs, have a developed single-family housing development plan and policy where we're seeing a lot of rehab, particularly in older communities like Southern Clay County, Ruskin Heights, the east side. And then finally on infrastructure, not that there will be no potholes. I'm not going to promise that. What I do want to promise is that we have a better plan for how we address infrastructure concerns, not just react to a tough winter, but instead saying this is our resurfacing plan so voters can say you're not just getting surprised by it. We're actually showing what we're doing ahead.
You know, obviously the highlight of your day is this appearance on KCUR's Up to Date, but what else is on your agenda one day after? I mean, where are you going today?
You know, other than talking to good folks like you, I have you know, I have some calls to make. And I said I was going to call the superintendents of every public school district. I plan to do that. There are 14 in Kansas City, Missouri, so I look forward to talking to them. I look forward to calling the chief of police. And I've been very lucky that I did not catch his call yet, but Senators Blunt and Hawley have reached out. I look forward to talking to them again, Congressman Cleaver, Congressman Graves, and letting everybody know I look forward to working with them.
We're joined here in the studio by KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez, KMBC's Mike Mahoney. Lisa, you have a question for the mayor-elect here?
Mm. I mean, following you, Steve, I'm not sure.
Mike, do you want to dive in here? Do you got something that you're pressing to ask before we lose them?
On the housing, Mr. Mayor, where is the money going to come from?
You know, Mike, I think there is money there. I think the money, as I said before, comes from actually using funding sources that already exist. Community development block grant dollars that we're getting from HUD every year. 8-cent sales tax, which I think is going to be a core one. And then, frankly, you know, where else from City Hall? We already use a number of different funds, including the capital improvement sales tax, sometimes to help economic development projects where it relates to, I think, public infrastructure development. I'd like to see us be creative in those sorts of ways in terms of creating more and fixing up more housing stock.
You've been critical of the $10 million that are being spent on housing demolition.
Yes.
Do you anticipate reducing the scope of that?
You know, I was asked that in the KMBC Channel 9 debate by a really avid questioner, and I think my short answer is yes. I continue to think that we should not have a standalone $10 million source for demolition without any funding to rehab. Preservation is important in every community of Kansas City, particularly in aging East Side neighborhoods, and I say that as a person who's from there. I do not want to see entire blocks torn down because you get vacant lots, you have long-term concerns with that.
But some of those homes that fall into disrepair end up being havens for crime.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I'm not saying you eliminate demolition. You continue to have a dangerous buildings department. You continue to address it, but I think we need to also address rehab every step of the way with it.
Lisa Rodriguez.
There was also a big bike plan, a $400 million bike plan that was, the debate was pushed off until after the election. Right. You expressed some reservations about it. Does that face a greater challenge now moving forward?
It always faced a great challenge. Here's the deal. I support bike lanes. I think they're important. I think they're helpful and key to the future of the city. We are just having a back and forth about a $75 million housing fund. And a lot of folks say, where are you going to get that money from? And I understand because people tweet at me about this. The $400 million is coming from a different source. Yeah, but it's still public funding. It's still the same type of infrastructure funding that is important and needs to go to things like repairing and fixing bridges, repairing and fixing roads, repairing and fixing so much of our public infrastructure in Kansas City. So I think the number is high. I'd like to see how the policy works better.
That's Mayor-elect Quentin Lucas of the city of Kansas City, Missouri, coming here on the wings of his powerhouse performance last night, winning by 16 points over Jolie Justice. Mayor-elect Lucas, congratulations again. Thanks for your time today. We'll look forward to having you in here soon, okay?
Thanks, Steve. Look forward to being in touch.
All the best to you, yeah. Okay, we're joined here in the studio by Mike Mahoney from KMBC and Lisa Rodriguez, who covers City Hall for KCUR. Let's talk about the results for mayor. I mean, surprised by the 16-point win last night, Lisa? What do you make of it?
I think everyone was a little surprised. I think that we all expected this to be a very close race, especially, you know, the way the final weeks of the campaign rolled out. But it really was a commanding victory for Mayor-elect Lucas, and I think we were all a little surprised. Surprised by it.
Did you see 16 points last night, Mike, going in?
I'm with Lisa on this. Nobody saw 16 points, but the folks that watched this stuff real closely were keeping an eye on the results, the early results that came in from Clay County.
Yes.
Clay County reported early, and the Justice campaign wanted to dominate in Clay County. They literally wanted
didn't happen.
They literally wanted a 60-40 margin up there. Jolie Justice won Clay County by 2 points. That destroyed her margin and any room for error in the Kansas City South. Lucas campaign didn't anticipate that. The Justice campaign didn't anticipate this point spread. I don't know anybody in town that did.
I want to put this win in perspective because Jolie Justice, people might forget, won the primary, and she won it handily by 5 points, 2,300 votes over Quentin Lucas. That's a lot, Lisa, and I'm wondering what your sense is of why Quentin was able to catch her and then beat her by more than 11,000 votes. I mean, again, it was a stunning performance.
It was, and I think, you know, looking back, I think that she maybe peaked at that primary while Lucas was really gaining momentum there. But I also think that after the primary, her campaign changed a little bit. And I think rather than focusing on her strengths and her experience, and particularly her endorsement from current Mayor Sly James, who is still very popular, I think she distanced herself from that. And I think those were key strengths that may have made a difference.
Maybe she didn't really quite know where to go and what to do about that.
Right.
The turnout last night, Mike, what can you tell us about that?
That people don't vote in municipal elections, and it's crazy because those are the elections that have the most impact on your streets, who picks up your garbage, whether your street lights are fixed, whether or not your roads are in good shape. Everybody complains about presidential politics and national politics. The rubber hits the road right here in town.
Absolutely.
And why people don't get that is astonishing. I want to go back to another thing and sort of talk about what Lisa was bringing up here. I also think that while these were two similar candidates in many different ways, I think voters were anxious for some change, and they viewed the Justice campaign and Julie Justice as at least a continuation of the Sly James administration. And the other thing is that in terms of pizzazz, charisma, whatever personality, whatever you want to say, Quentin Lucas demonstrated that he had a more outgoing personality than Julie Justice in the minds of many voters. Now, that's not to say that Julie Justice is not a nice, pleasant woman, because she is, but his personality is stronger than hers, and I think voters connected with that.
I was going to say, you're taking my next question out of my mouth here, Lisa. Quentin Lucas was able to connect. There is that charisma factor there, and you know, Julie Justice had some of that, but you get a sense that, you know, Quentin Lucas, you see a politician like that not all that often. He just has so much of it.
He really does, and I do think, you know, when you speak to Julie Justice one-on-one, a lot of people do feel like they really connect to her. And I think maybe her strength was that wasn't always on display in a public forum. She is a little bit reserved and has been on the city council. She was a little bit more reserved in TV and debates. So I think it was just, you know, Quentin Lucas's strength really, really shone there. And so I think that may have been part of it.
You know, Mike Mahoney, the challenges now that Quentin Lucas faces, he's obviously got a very much new city council to work with, several new members. We don't really know a whole lot about them. What are the challenges, the immediate challenges he faces in the 6 weeks before he takes over?
Number one, to build up a mayor's staff. Number two, to make all sorts of calls like he was describing here, reaching out to the school superintendent, to the chief of police.
Bill Bridges.
The other thing is to get with the new city council that does have veterans on it and will also have new, fresh faces, and get them to buy in, at least for the short term, what his vision and how he wants to move forward on that. And all of these people that are on the city council, the other 12, and in particular the people that were elected this year or last night, say that I've got a mission here too, and he needs to be able to marry his vision and theirs. And I think that if he plays his cards well, he'd have an opportunity to have a bit of a honeymoon here by going, folks, let me lead this, and we'll see where it goes. But he needs to reach out and build some bridges and establish a vision.
What surprised you about the results for the city council seats themselves, Lisa? Any upsets there? Any collective direction you can discern from where this group is going to want to go? Or is it simply too early?
I'm not sure that I was super surprised by any of the results there, but I think it is clear that there is a different makeup on the city council. The last prior city council was really dominated by lawyers and people who had had careers in politics or been involved in some way or another. And now we have fresh faces that are certainly no strangers to the issues in their neighborhoods and their communities, but there are fewer lawyers. There are fewer politicians in there. And I think that'll be a really interesting thing to watch.
Okay. That's some good post-election analysis there from Lisa Rodriguez, who covers City Hall for KCUR. Mike Mahoney, veteran reporter, covers politics for KMBC-TV. Thank you both for a good conversation.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back in the studio with you.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about summer reading for kids and offer you some good recommendations that give the kiddos something to do this summer. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, Wyandotte County's district attorney talked with us about an expungement assistance program and gave us an update on his conviction integrity unit. Find that conversation and other previous episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, a sports roundup with KCUR contributor Greg Eklund. Well, summer vacation is starting to sink in a bit, so we thought it might be a good time to run down some good reading recommendations for the kids home from school. Remember books? Believe it or not, it's still considered a very viable option for kids of all ages, and the books we have today are aimed at capturing a child's focus and locking in those attention spans. Our guides today are three librarians from the Johnson County Public Library. They are Elena McVicker, the Youth Collections Librarian. Elena, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Dennis Ross is back. He's the Youth Services Supervisor. Dennis, good morning.
Good morning.
Debbie McLeod is our Librarian Emerita. Debbie, good to have you too.
Hi, Steve.
And if kids at home have some recommendations for us, we'd like to hear from them. In fact, we'd love to hear from them. 816-235-2888. If they're reading a good book and they want to share some thoughts, 816-235-2888. Debbie, should we just launch right in here?
Sure.
Let's just launch right in here. Elena, let's talk about a book, One of Us is Lying, by Karen McManus. It's recommended for grades 9 and up.
Yes, I think this is, if you're getting ready to go on vacation, I highly, highly recommend picking this book up for teens and adults. It's a super fast read. It's if The Breakfast Club ended in murder. So it's like Breakfast Club meets Gossip Girl. So the brain, the jock, the princess, the basket case, and a criminal all enter detention. One leaves on a stretcher and later dies in the hospital, and the remaining four quickly become prime suspects that murder.
Okay. We have a little excerpt here from this book, One of Us is Lying, from Michelle Tyrene Johnson. She's KCUR's race, identity, and culture reporter. Michelle.
All right. I got the idea for Killing Simon while watching Dateline. I'd been thinking about it for a while, obviously. That's not the kind of thing you pluck out of thin air. But the how of getting away with it always stopped me. I don't kid myself that I'm a criminal mastermind, and I'm much too good looking for prison. On the show, a guy killed his wife. Standard Dateline stuff, right? It's always the husband. But turns out, lots of people were happy to see her gone. She'd gotten a coworker fired, screwed over people on city council, and had an affair with the friend's husband. She was a nightmare, basically. The guy on Dateline wasn't too bright, hired someone to murder his wife, and the cell phone records were easy to trace. But before those came out, he had a decent smoke screen because of all the other suspects. That's the kind of person you can get away with killing, someone everyone else wants dead. Let's face it. Everyone at Bayview High hated Simon. I was just the only one with enough guts to do something about it. You're welcome.
That's Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Okay, reading from One of Us is Lying by Karen McManus. Thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Okay, Debbie, let's move over to you here in a book, New Kid by Jerry Kraft. This is recommended for grades 5 through 8.
Yeah, this is a great little book. It's a graphic novel, and it tells the story of Jordan, who loves to draw cartoons, and he wants to go to this art school. That's his dream. But what his parents decide is that academics are just as important as art. So they take him out of his inner city school and put him in this prestigious private school. So not only is he going from elementary school to middle school, he's also going to a totally different school with a totally different group of class of people. He's the only African-American kid, it seems like, in the school. Plus, he's kind of a nerd because he likes to draw. So how he fits in, there's all these different levels. It is funny. It is true. It's a really, really great graphic novel for kids.
Okay, that book again, New Kid by Jerry Kraft, again for grades 5 through 8. Dennis, let's go to Dig by Amy King here.
Yeah, this is the book that she came out with last year. It's recommended for middle school and up. And like pretty much all of Amy's books, what it looks like it's about is not what it's really about. The cover art is about potatoes underground. And it does start out talking about a potato farming, but really what it's about, like most of her books, is about an assortment of oddball misfit teens. They all live sort of within a few miles of each other, but they don't really know each other. They're all misfits and loners, and their lives are connected in ways that they only gradually discover as the book goes along, and that ends kind of dramatically, and they all come together. So she sets up these absurd situations. She uses magical realism and kind of surrealistic situations, and she uses them to illustrate very real issues in the lives of young people. In this case, it's abuse and prejudice and white privilege and systemic racism and loneliness. And that's what she's really talking about.
Okay.
And ultimately, the book, like all of her books, is really about love.
Mm. Okay. That book, again, Dig, by Amy Sarig King, again, recommended for middle school and up. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. We're hoping some kids will call with some recommendations for what they're reading. And here's one of them right now, Marley from Kansas City, Missouri. Marley, you're on Up to Date. Thanks for calling us.
Hi.
Hi.
I like Mustaches for Maddie because... Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that.
I like it because it's interesting. And why I think it is interesting is because she has a brain tumor that makes her hand curl up.
Wow.
So I like that the kids still are nice to her.
Oh, they're still nice to her. That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Mustaches for Maddie, you nodded your head pretty vigorously, Debbie. You recognize that one.
Yes, it's a good book.
Yeah. Well, Marley, I'm sure glad you called. I hope you enjoy the rest of your summer, okay?
You too.
Okay, thanks again. Let's go to Elena, and she has a couple books she wants to talk about here. Fix a Car, and the second one, Bake Like a Pro, for grades 5 and up.
Yeah, these books are graphic novels, and they're nonfiction graphic novels that illustrate a skill or how to do something. So I have Fix a Car and Bake Like a Pro, but they also have Create a Costume, Grow a Garden, Draw a Comic, and Build a Robot. So if you're a visual learner, I highly recommend these books. They go into technical detail, but not enough that it's overwhelming. I know next to nothing about cars and fixing cars, and I read through the car book, and now I at least sort of have a better understanding of what's going on underneath the hood. I still can't fix anything, but they're really helpful if you're a visual person, and they just do such a good job of combining a story with technical detail.
So you can learn how to fix a car and bake like a pro.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty good.
Make a comic and all kinds of stuff.
Okay. Those books, again, Fix a Car and Bake Like a Pro. Let's move on to The Bridge Home here. Debbie, tell us about it.
Yeah, this tells the story. It takes place in India, and it tells the story of Viji and her older sister, Ruku. And her father has abused her mother and also her sister. Mm. And the book is told from the point of view of Viji, and she is writing a letter to Ruku. And she relates all their adventures that they have had. They run away, and they are homeless in India, which is, I mean, a very real thing over there. And they meet up with two boys, and they make themselves their own family, and they survive. I mean, it's a great survival story.
Wow.
I highly recommend it. The writing is just fantastic.
This takes kids into a world they don't know a whole lot about. It's
very,
for grades,
very much.
Grades 4 through 6, right?
Yes.
Okay, Danny Alexander, Up to Date's producer, has an excerpt here from The Bridge Home.
You ran a finger around the edges of what felt like a painful bruise blooming on my cheek. "Awa," you said, paying no attention to your own wound. Poor Viji. With her unbroken arm, Amma grabbed a towel. She dipped it into the cool water in our earthen pot and pressed it against your bleeding lip. You struggled until I promised it would help you heal. "Leave Appa," I told Amma. "Let's go somewhere else." "How would we live, Viji?" "We'll find a way." "We can't manage without him. No one employs uneducated women with no skills." Her voice was flat, defeated. "Just don't talk back anymore, Viji. I couldn't stand it if he hurt you again." "He hurts you all the time," I said. "And now that he's started on us, nothing's going to stop him." She didn't argue. Her head drooped, and when she finally found the strength to lift her eyes to mine, I could see she knew what I'd said was true. "I can't bear seeing you hurt, but how can I stop him?" She gazed at the pictures of the gods and goddesses smiling down serenely from our kitchen wall, as if they'd suddenly leap into life and start helping. "Please understand, Viji," she was begging me, the same pathetic way she begged Appa. "I promised to be a good wife, no matter what. I can't leave." But after what he'd done to you, I couldn't say. As I gazed at Amma's trembling chin, I realized how different we were. Amma trusted that if she put up with things, she'd be rewarded with another, better life after she died. It made no sense to me why any god who made us suffer in this life would start caring for us in the next. If I wanted a better future, I needed to change the life we had. Now. The more I thought about our differences, the surer I felt that I could protect you better than she could. She hadn't tried to stop Appa from beating us. All she'd done was beg. I would never become like her, I promised myself. I'd never beg anyone for anything.
That's Up to Date's Danny Alexander reading from The Bridge Home, recommended for grades 4 through 6. Thanks, Danny. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking with our Johnson County librarians about some good recommendations for summertime reads here. Let's move down the road, and Dennis, tell us about Harbor Me by Jacqueline Woodson. Again, another good one for grades 4 through 6.
Yes, it's another one of my, another one of my favorites from last year. And you're right, it's about 4th to 6th grade. It's about 6 students, and they're in 5th and 6th grades, and they're on a special class for people who learn differently. And their teacher unexpectedly gives them 1 hour a week where they get to, on each Friday, they get to go to a room and sit there by themselves with no adults and talk about anything they want, or they can just talk about nothing at all. And they're just, they don't know what to do with that. So at first, they're just so confused, they just kind of sit and look at each other. And then gradually, they each start telling the others their stories. And they all have, you know, kind of hard stories. One of them's father's been taken away by immigration services. One of them is one of the school's only white kids, and he gets bullied all the time. And another one is worried about being shot, so he sketches guns all the time. And one of them is Puerto Rican descent, and so he struggles with being an American but not really an American. And one of them's father's in jail and her mother's dead. So they all start telling each other their stories and gradually get support and understanding from each other, which I think might have been what the teacher had in mind. But as always, with Jacqueline Woodson's writing is always so beautiful and so poetic. You know, it's prose, but it's almost like you're reading poetry. There's like every word is in exactly the right place, and there aren't any extra ones.
Yeah.
And they all just pierce straight to the heart of the characters and right straight to the heart of the reader every time. The teacher told them, if the worst thing in the world happened, would I help protect someone else? Would I let myself be a harbor for someone who needs it? And she said, I want you to say to each other, I will harbor you.
Wow.
And by the end of the book, they do.
Harbor Me is the title of the book by Jacqueline Woodson. You know, I always wonder, authors like that, if they set out to write a book for grades 4 through 6, or do they write the book and then figure out later what the age-appropriate level is for that book? What comes first?
Most authors that I have read interviews with will tell you that it's kind of a combination of the two. They have a story they really want to tell, and they want to tell it the best way they can. But also, they may have a contract with a publisher who says, we need you to write this middle grade book, or a middle grade book. So I think it's a combination. Isn't that what you think, too?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. And I also think a lot of authors that I've heard speak often say they're not thinking about, like, specific grades as more as, like, she probably, when she had this book in mind, was like, I want to write something for younger people. Or whoever might be touched by the story.
That's interesting.
And a lot of time, then the publishers come in and assign specific grade levels to things.
Once the book has been turned in.
Right.
So
I think it's a combination of all of that. But I think a lot of times, the author have a story they want to tell, and then they have a general idea of what, you know, adult, middle grade, YA, that they're aiming for.
And a lot of these books are good on multi-levels, too. You know, they just write to tell their story, and where it falls, that's where it falls. And you're right, it's the publisher that decides what they're going to target it for, or who they're targeting this for.
Yeah. This is interesting, that the themes that are emerging to me from these books we've read about so far, a lot of ethnicity, a lot of kids on their own in the world, maybe lost, drifting a little bit. I mean, am I picking that up?
Yeah, it seems to be a trend. Well, we're looking for more diversity in children's books, and there's been a very big push on that to introduce ethnic authors. So you're seeing a lot of that. You're seeing that, the publishers want to bring the kids into the real world and the empathy. Everything isn't just what you have in your town, in your street, whatever, that you have to look at it as a worldwide thing. And so part of children's books is you want to teach them empathy. And the way that you teach them that is to show them experiences that other kids have that they might not be familiar with.
Right, right. Let's go back to some phone calls. And we have Tyler on the line from Shawnee. He's 10 years old. Tyler, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a book recommendation. It's called Warcross.
Huh. Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone seems to know what that book is. Right. Can you describe it to us, Tyler?
It's about the future, about this girl who accidentally hacks into a virtual reality game and then gets to know the person who created it and has to find out something about someone hacking into the game.
Huh. Okay. This is part of a series of books by Marie Lu. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Hey, I'm glad you called, Tyler. Thanks very much.
Yep, you're welcome.
Have a great summer. Yeah. Elena, you're up next with a book, You Are New. This is for grades ages 4 through 6, so for young kids here.
Yeah, this is a picture book by Lucy Nisley. She typically writes adult and upper YA graphic novels. And so I was really interested to see how she made the transition from that to a picture book, because writing picture books is hard. You have a limited amount of text. To get the perfect words on the page is kind of hard. And a
you
lot
wouldn't
of,
think it's hard.
You wouldn't think it's hard because,
but
and I
is,
think that's
yeah.
a misconception because it's such a tiny little book with so little words.
Yeah.
But that's where the difficulty comes in. A lot of people who write longer, bigger books have trouble kind of cutting out things to simple sentences. But she does such a great job. I was so impressed. So if you have, it's called You Are New, and it's about being a baby and all the things you get to learn and touch and see. And sometimes being new is hard because you have so many things to learn. But the rhyme scheme is great. It has a really great cadence. If you're looking for a book for a new person in your life, I highly recommend grabbing this. She also does a great job with the illustrations. She leaves a lot of white space on the page. And her little babies are so bright and colorful and unique and different and cute that I was just really impressed by this picture book. It's really fun to read. It's a great read aloud. Yeah, if you're looking for a book to share or to gift to someone, I recommend this.
That book again, You Are New by Lucy Nisley. It's K-N-I-S-L-E-Y, again, for ages 4 through 6. Debbie, let's go to a book, Vamos, by Raul III.
Yes, that's his pen name.
Pen name, sure.
His real name is Raul Gonzalez. And he's especially known for a graphic novel that he did a couple of years ago, Low Riders to the Center of the Earth, which won the Pearl Belpre Award for Illustration. And this book, the more I read it, the more I love this. It'd be a great vacation book. You know, give it to the kids on the back of the car. There's a lot to see. But it tells the story of Little Lobo and his dog, Bernardé. And they make deliveries to the Mercado. And different vendors, like a candy maker, a person who makes piñatas, the person who is in charge of the comic books. And he just makes his little stops, makes his friends. There's words in English and Spanish, so you can learn Spanish as you read it. And there's so much to see as you go through this book. You know, like, oh, here's this person, because he mentions he wants to see this hero of his. And meanwhile, he's in the little crowd. And so you go back and you look for it some more. And you look at the piñatas, and there's somebody you'll recognize in the piñatas. And it's just so much fun. There's so much to see every time you look at it. I just think it would be so much fun to have in the car. Give it to the kids. They can go over it over and again and again and again.
And Vamos means we go, right?
Right.
Here we go.
That's good.
Yeah. Vamos by Raul III, again for grades K through 4. Maybe that might be a reach, maybe on the 4 side.
Well, I think the older kids, they might like it because of the humor in the illustrations, because there's stuff in there that the little kids might not exactly pick up. There's things in here that the adults will pick up that they'll think is pretty humorous. So it's something that it won't tire you out.
Okay, Dennis, let's go to the next book here. Yeah. The Girl Who Drew Butterflies, How Maria Marion's Art Changed Science by Joyce Sidman. This is for grades 5 through 8, The Girl Who Drew Butterflies.
Right, and it's How Maria Marion's Art Changed Science. And the short description in the catalog reads, explores the extraordinary life and scientific discoveries of Maria Marion, who discovered the truth about metamorphosis and documented the science behind the mystery. And that is just a huge understatement. She lived in the 1600s. She had no formal training or education at all. In fact, you know, as you probably know, in 1600s in Europe, women were rarely allowed any responsibilities outside the home, and having unusual interests often led to being accused of witchcraft. So it wasn't exactly encouraged usually. But her stepfather was an artist, and he illustrated flowers and other nature scenes, and so he would send her out to find insects because he thought that made his illustrations look more realistic if he could include insects, and she was just a naturally curious person, and he taught her to draw too. And so the more she studied the insects, the more fascinated she got with them, and the more closely she studied them, and then she started raising them and studying them even more closely and drawing them again. And the author says that she had the curiosity of a true scientist, the patience it took to raise insects, and the superb artistic skill to share her observations. And that she did. So she was fascinated. She studied them like a scientist. And at the time, the prevailing theory was that insects came from spontaneous generation. And she was the first person to study and prove and document the life cycle and metamorphosis of insects, and then illustrate them in beautiful ways.
Oh, there
so
you go.
This book has a little bit of everything. It has photographs of insects. It has maps. It has reproductions of her own just beautiful paintings, as you can see here. Everybody on the radio can see that, right? And yeah. Pages with cultural context, like about religion in the 1600s, and to give a little context of the life of the times and the limitations on women's lives. And so everything about the way it's put together is just really, really well done. It's very highly recommended.
The book again, The Girl Who Drew Butterflies by Joyce Sidman.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sophia from Kansas City, Missouri. Sophia, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi.
What book would you recommend, Sophia?
Wonder by R.J. Palacio.
Oh, yes.
Yay.
Oh.
Tell us about that book, Sophia.
It's a book about a kid who has a facial disability, and he there's friends of his who don't even need to hang out with him, but they decide to, even though a lot of kids think he's weird, but through the light, some light shines. Or through the darkness, some light shines.
Wow. Yeah. So Wonder by R.J. Palacio, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you called to recommend that one, Sophia. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Elena, how about With the Fire on High by Elizabeth Acevedo?
Yeah, her previous book, The Poet X, won the Michael L. Prince Award, and so I was really excited to get my hands on her follow-up, and she totally delivers. It's about a girl named Imani, and she is a single parent, a single teenage parent, and she's also an incredibly talented chef. And so it follows her trying to get through high school, parent her child, co-parent with, her fellow, with her, the guy she got pregnant with, and deal with her grandma's maybe failing health. And I just think her writing is so beautiful. And the way she describes food is so amazing that you should probably have a lot of snacks with you when you read it. But what I also like about this book, especially for summer, is the chapters are fairly short. Her previous book was written in verse, and she is writing in prose here, but the chapters are maybe 2 or 3 pages. Huh. And so it's easy to
pick up and put down.
Yeah, if you need to, if you're running around in summer and you need to pick it up and put it down. But it also is just so immersive that if you do find yourself with a couple hours, you're like, oh, I read a bunch of chapters all at once.
That book again, With a Fire on High by Elizabeth Acevedo. And we'll try to put a complete list of all our books on our website later on today. You'll find it at kcur.org. Just check on up to date. I want to thank our great Johnson County librarians for coming in and sharing their recommendations as usual. Elena McVicker, Dennis Ross, and Debbie McLeod. As always, guys, thanks so much for coming.
It's always
appreciate
fun.
It. Yeah, you bet.
Very fun.
Yesterday on the show, we learned about bat bombs, acoustic cats, and other crazy spy schemes. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up to date. Tomorrow, our friend Greg Eklund is back with a mostly off-season update on Kansas City sports scene. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.